One year later, I just looked at this decomposition and saw that I had decomposed a semi-martingale f of xt with f excessive. So I just took what was done for Markov process and I translated it into semi-martingale language, including the semi-group and so on. So really, the problem of semi-martingales was, of super-martingales, was never solved in itself. It was solved from Markov processes, by Markov processes methods, and then it turned out that it went that way. But it was a very difficult problem to attack by a frontal attack.
Yes, because there existed no
experience.
Yes, and there existed experience in Markov process.
In fact, Chung had given the problem, he told me, he had given the problem, that problem to Ornstein, and Ornstein was too clever. He thought about it for one afternoon, maybe, and came and said, well, this doesn't work. There is a counterexample. So...
But how did it happen? General theory. This is, of course, a very important thing. And a very basic thing. And this is nice. Cross-section lemma, for example, that's
The idea was taken more or less from vague statements. I don't know. I think I got the idea from Hunt too, in some way. That is, to generalize what Hunt had done by putting a compact set inside of an open set. But... I did that during my military service, in fact. Almost nothing to do, and I was working on that, but all my proofs were wrong.
Well, that's not important.
That's not important when finally the theorem is true. But all my proofs were wrong, and, it was also the same, of course, with my thesis. Oh, yes, and... With this theorem on predictable, I essentially made the error of thinking that all accessible times were predictable. It was Neveu that was in a paper on martingale decomposition or something like that. I showed that to Neveu and he said, "Well, what does that give in discrete time?" And of course, it was entirely wrong, because it was really the difference between accessible and predictable. But for some reason, when that error was detected, the work on Markov processes contained the way to correct it, essentially. So I wasn't quite caught by that. At the same time, the mistake was...
Of course, all these things are in your first book, well measurable probably is a terrible term from the point of view of language.
Predictable and optional are big contributions of Chung to that theorem.
But the concept itself is so natural and so important. It took some time for me to absorb this and to...
Yes, but it took some time for me too. That is, it's funny that the idea of an optional process, which is more difficult than that of a predictable process, was known before. Everything is simpler. The predictable section theorem is simpler than the optional section theorem, and it was proved long after. And possibly, the year where you should ask de la Chrie, he remembers that better. But as far as I remember, the predictable section theorem was the answer to a question of Chung in Markov chains.
And what about optional?
Optional was known long before.
Yes, but also been introduced by yourself. I don't think that
yes,
it existed.
Yes. That was the generalization of the fact that hit in an open set, you can put some compact set and take the hit in time. That was the idea.
Just now I finished a paper on Dirichlet spaces, and I enjoyed removing all topology, all capacities, everything. No, nothing is necessary besides this cross-section theorem and general theory. And you get everything very, very nicely. Of course, a Choquet theorem is still behind, but you do not use it explicitly. And
yes,
it's very nice.
But also, here there is an... Behind these things, there is an unpublished paper of Blackwell. I don't know how I got that paper. And I don't think it was ever published. I got it when I was a student in Berkeley. He was trying just to get rid of Choquet's theorem and to use measure theory, ordinary measure theory, the Sierpinski theorem that if you perform a Suslin operation, you get a universally measurable set. And that was the place where I got... Of course, I didn't want to get rid of the Choquet theorem myself. It had been sufficiently hard for me to learn it. I wanted to use it. But this is the place where I got the idea of using Choquet theory just on the sample, on the omega cross R plus itself, not on the state space, which was what Hunt had done. But of course, the basic idea in all this field was of using the Choquet theorem at all. And that was Hunt's idea. To see the measurability of hitting times using Choquet's theorem was Hunt's idea, because it's not in Dube's papers. Dube has a... Because Brownian motion has continuous paths, Dube has a trick.
Yes,
he can avoid the Choquet theorem.
Sure. And
of course, that's...
This makes things much simpler, right?
But it was really a fantastic idea, that of using this paper of Choquet, which is a difficult paper, and to have known it first and to use it in probability theory.
I never knew how Hunt managed to know Choquet theory.
Well, I think maybe Choquet told him. Choquet had gone to the United States. Maybe one should check. But maybe it was Choquet himself.
Yes, which is a nice, if this is the case, this is a good example of importance of personal context.
Yes.
For example, I could not imagine how we in Moscow, working on Markov processes, would discover this Choquet theory.
Yes, of course.
But you know, I don't think that anybody, Kolmogorov or anybody, had any idea that such kind of thing could be of use.
But Choquet's paper was probably one of the great mathematical papers of this century. You know, people have not exhausted what is in this paper. One could still give that paper to students and get new mathematics out of it, I believe.
And, how this Strasbourg group arose? How did it happen?
Well, probably for the same reason I went into probability, that is, some people were trying to get out of Paris. Christians, and they found
my impression was that just opposite. Paris always attracted
but there was too much pressure in Paris for students to get somebody that would care for them. For instance, in my generation, one saw one's thesis director maybe twice a year. But I don't even remember in which order exactly people came. Among the students, the non-students or non-students, older people who came to Strasbourg in the early years, well, of course, there were de la Chrie, but he wasn't among
also
the first ones. But Catherine de Leon was among the first ones to come, and definitely she was trying to get somebody who would care for her, because in Paris it was almost impossible. And maybe it was Courage who told her to come to Strasbourg. But also Renzo Cairoli came quite early. He had been working with Neveu, and since he was coming back to Switzerland, he was looking for some place close to Switzerland. And de la Chrie came, there were Morandeau, who later on went into teaching rather than mathematics. Research, mathematical research, but,
and then
Veil was already there in Strasbourg.
Revues?
No, Revues wasn't. Revues wasn't in. Didn't work with us. He belonged to another group. The Revues.
Oh, but he didn't. Something close to your.
No, he worked with Neveu Revues. There were the first generation of people in Paris. I think the first one, they were Prioré, Revues, Azema, and Marie Duflo. That was the first generation in Paris, but he was independent from Neveu in some way. That was Bretagnol, Dacuna Castel, and Krivin at the same time. And these were entirely independent. They studied alone. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they know essentially much more classical probability theory than we do. Because there were people still before them, for instance, like Hennequin and Fuchs, who studied with Forte, mm-hmm. still before. These people didn't learn really measure theory. That was a pre-measure theory generation, and they lost the part of their capacities for research because of that training. Without a sufficient background, it was impossible in France. They did very good work.
So how your seminar worked?
Well,
like
any other seminar in the world, the two things that maybe that were peculiar to our seminar, that made it finally rather well known. One was the fact that the lecture notes in mathematics were starting more or less at that time. We didn't catch the lecture notes at the beginning, but we must be in the first seminar volume must be in 60 or 80 in the lecture notes, which is pretty close to the beginning. So the idea of publishing things.
Yes, this was something absolutely heroic, I would say. Of course, that's in French tradition. There existed Seminar Brelot, Denis,
yes,
Cartan, and so on.
But it doesn't reach the whole world like the lecture notes. And the idea was very quite definite of publishing at the same time the things of the, say, older members of the seminar and the things done by the beginners. Because I thought that probably was my idea. I thought that would be very quite stimulating for them. And also I liked the idea of publishing papers without proof correcting and the referees' comments. And but the other idea that was good was that of organizing meetings twice a year. With people coming from Paris, because it was quite difficult for these people in Paris to organize something because of lack of room in Paris. Yes. While Strasbourg, we had plenty of room, and Strasbourg is a very pleasant city to organize something. And well, so people got used to coming to
Mezdenev has mentioned some kind of family atmosphere at this seminar, so like a big family, something like that.
Well, this is also some kind of idealization, but it's true that there couldn't be anything but a family atmosphere, since approximately all people were of the same age. And, you know.
And you also, were informal or formal. How it worked?
Certainly there was no chairman and
No, but speaker, say. Was it possible for a speaker to speak and nobody to listen?
Oh, yes, sure.
It would certainly be impossible for a Gilfand seminar. Gilfand would interrupt immediately and in very rough, rude, I would say, way.
Oh, yes.
I never was rude, but still I at my seminars also would probably stop any speaker if I would see nobody follows him.
They were terrible things. They were terribly boring talks, of course, and there was also nobody to tell some speaker that he was maybe speaking 2 hours instead of one, and everybody would just try to sleep.
So with this respect, you were more academic.
And
why not? I believe that dialogue in many cases is better than monologue and polyphonic performance even.
Of course, and of course, the people, when the talk was interesting, then people would follow and make comments just in the middle and interrupt the speaker, and of course that's nice, that makes things lively. But we had a problem. I don't have any special name to give, but we certainly had a lot of extremely boring talks, possibly including by myself.
why in this informal atmosphere not to stop boring talks?
How could it? Oh, it's complicated for my English. How could it have been otherwise? Who could have had the authority to stop other people? There was nobody who could have any authority.
Mm-hmm. Just asking questions, of course, not necessary to be rude. It is possible to ask, what really do you want to prove?
One really wanted to know what he really wanted to prove, which wasn't always the case, because in some cases people were trying to prove things that didn't interest anybody.
Yes, but also a method of successive approximations is nice. First, to learn what the person is driving at, and then just say... it's possible to suggest or to omit all details of proofs, or you usually went through all details?
Well, I think so. I think so.
I see.
The talks were not very, people were reporting on things they had done just recently, and everybody was working approximately on the same things. It was mostly on theory of processes at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But really, nobody had any authority to say anything to the others, I think.
So it was very democratic.
Yes, sure.
No, but...
It was a slightly different problem, of course, when we began to have people coming, for instance, from Germany. We had, for some years, we had people coming from Heidelberg. And, of course, with people coming from Germany, things must be a little more formal.
Of course, you should be...
One must be careful to
not to offend them.
Not to offend people and to give due applause at the end of talks and to say, are there any questions? No, but the collaboration with people from Heidelberg, for instance, Hermann Rost and Waldenfels and other people, has been very, very pleasant. But we had some difficulties. One of, or two times in the history of the seminar, manuscripts were published. Well, half of the manuscript was lost, or things like that. That gave a lot of trouble.
Lost by whom?
Of course, by me.
No, but nowadays it is always possible to have Xerox copies.
No, but I sent them to Springer without checking that they were complete.
So it has been published in such a way?
Yes, yes. Ah. So one had to put rectifications and the next. That was, these were rather worrying things. No. It's bad.
Not very important. Of course, everybody tries to avoid errors in papers. But still, the best papers contain some mistakes. For example, each paper of Feller, I believe, contained at least one substantial error.
Well,
which, of course...
One has good errors and bad errors, and of course, often errors plays a very positive role,
because
if one knew in advance how complicated things can be, then probably one would never prove theorems.
Yeah.